Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. Joining me today is Aaron Alexander, the author of The Align Method. Aaron is very well known, especially in the fitness industry. Aaron believes that there is a direct correlation between our physical health and our psychological well-being. So this entire podcast is really based on so many things that I have neglected to talk about on this podcast. We speak about psychology, we speak about trauma, and we speak about how a lot of things that happen to us as children can show up in our adult lives. And they can actually show up and manifest in ways that I never thought possible, such as an injury or a little niggle in our body can actually be a sign of untreated trauma. And this episode really made me dig deep. I spoke to Aaron about everything and even his wonderful book, which is A Modern Movement Guide for a Stronger Body, Sharper Mind, and Stress-Proof Life. If you see Aaron on Instagram, which you should go through and have a look at his Instagram, you'll see that he really is all about alignment and stress-proof. At any given moment, he's stretching, he's jumping, he's working out, he's in the ice bath, he's in the sauna, he's doing some breath work. He's an absolute pillar of health. However, it took him a long time to get here. I know you're going to like this episode because not only do I interview him, but he also interviews me. So I hope you enjoy today's episode. And if you do, please go through, screenshot the episode, pop it in your Instagram stories, or better yet, go through and leave us a written review. Let's get into the episode. This episode is brought to you by Ketone IQ. We all know that feeding your brain correctly is absolutely essential for optimal performance. But where does your brain cells get their energy from? They get it from mitochondria. So having efficient mitochondria is key to keeping your brain energized and functioning at its best. Luckily, there's a way to give your mitochondria a boost, and that is by consuming exogenous ketones. So exogenous ketones have been proven to not only increase the mitochondrial efficiency, but they've also been shown to improve the body's ability to burn fat more efficiently for fuel. This means that taking ketones, literally these ketones that I'm talking about come in a bottle and you sip it throughout the day. If you take these, if you sip on this throughout your day and make it your daily routine, it will give you an edge on productivity and mental clarity throughout the day. So for me personally, I have been using Ketone IQ from HVMN for a very long time now. And basically, it's made a huge difference in my cognitive performance because I'm able to keep going for longer, meaning that I work long hours. And if you guys follow me on Instagram, you know that I travel a lot. So my energy gets depleted. And I mean, very much so. So in order to keep up with the demands of life, I am supplementing with Ketone IQ from HVMN. So I highly recommend you trying them out. If you're looking for a clean and safe way to provide yourself with extra energy and have that mental clarity throughout the day, then I highly recommend Ketone IQ. Just head on over to hvmn.com, use code NEURO20 at checkout to get 20% off. That's hvmn.com. Go to checkout and use code NEURO20 to get 20% off.
What I became really interested in, and still am, is what is fitness and movement outside of when we're being intentional about it? And instead, like our daily life existence, like every day, every moment throughout the day, your body doesn't know the difference between, oh, okay, Louisa's in the gym. Oh, she's in the yoga studio. Oh, she's with a trainer. It's going through the same processes of deconstruction and reconstruction. You're always remodeling neurologically, musculoskeletally, you know, all your whole system is continually in process. So I'm really interested in uncovering some of those, kind of like shadow parts, I guess, in our movement. And so that comes into like lifestyle. So the way that you work, for example, the way that you hang out around your house, the way that you travel, the way that you use your breathing muscles, the way that you use your visual muscles, way that you communicate, all of that, that's the lion's share of your actual movement practice. It's just culturally, I don't think we pay too much attention to it.
I love what you said. Actually, that really hit something for me when you said that your body doesn't know the difference between being in the gym or just being in a regular job or whatever it is you're doing. Because I say that when it comes to things such as emotions with your brain or stress, your brain doesn't know the difference between being hit by a car or going through a terrible divorce, for example.
Yeah.
So if one of them is a more emotionally taxing, your brain doesn't say, oh, it's because I'm going through a divorce or I've been hit by a car, or it just says stress or just says pain. That's all it knows. But I've never heard, I've never heard anybody say that for the body. And that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And when you look evolutionarily, you know, we're always talking about what were we doing before the internet and before we had power. You know, our ancestors were going out, they were hunting, they were doing this. And so that's, you know, super interesting to hear that.
Yeah. And I've been through some emotional distress where I kind of had a moment of realization. One, as you already mentioned, they're processed in the same place in the brain. And there's probably a lot of more differentiation and variability of that than just the exact same place. You know a lot more about them than I do. But I personally, and other people perhaps could resonate, where I would take a broken anything over a broken heart. Because the broken heart, it's this everywhereness. Yeah. You don't know what to do. And it's anxiety and it's depression. It's so saturating.
You'd rather break your leg.
Oh, MG, yeah. Yeah. You break a femur, you're like, it sucks. You know, where you're like, there it is. There's the situation. Now suddenly I'm getting all this more care. I'm getting more compassion from the world. You know, like loneliness is compared to smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Oh, yeah. People, I read that statistic.
People are what is it? They're like 50% more likely to die prematurely. Lonely people are than people that feel like they have meaningful relationships in their lives.
Yeah.
You know, there's like endless statistics on that. And presently, the world, I would say, Western culture, is going through a mental health epidemic. And a lot of that can be treated with simple lifestyle choices to start. And then behind that, also, I think I know comes back to what's your emotional health. And the emotional health part, it's nebulous and it's weird and it's scary. And there are a lot of doors within most people, or at least myself, that we don't even realize we've never opened, and we don't even realize that we're terrified to open them.
Oh yeah.
And we've developed all these brilliant compensatory strategies in our lives to kind of buffer ourselves away from those places. And Moshe Feldenkrais, he's the guy who founded the Feldenkrais method. It's like a movement thing. He calls chronic tension in the body parasitic tension. So if you chronically have, you know, whatever, your mandible or your traps or your whatever, you know, some muscles in your pelvic floor or any place in the body, if they're chronically a bit tense throughout the day, you're expending caloric energy to maintain that compensatory strategy.
Wow. So I'm actually losing weight then. I'm losing calories.
That's one perspective to look at it.
But yeah. On that, because it's interesting, because I've chronically, so a lot of people listening to the podcast who are part of the Neuro Experience community know that I was an elite triathlete. I raced for Australia. I got hit by a car. And let me tell you, back to that femur thing, it's not pretty. I broke many bones. And as part of that, and that was back in 2012. Yeah, so I had to forfeit the Beijing world title. However, from that, I'm chronically, you know, I broke a few ribs as well. It was all on my right side. So just where the QL is, or just down on the T-spine on the right side, I'm chronically, like, it's always tight. I'm always sore. I'm going to my physical therapist like every 2 weeks. She's dry needling me. It feels incredible. I walk out, I feel on air for about a week, and then starts to get tight again. And I was going to ask, does this method that you speak about, is there different areas that are related to different emotional traumas? Or, like, you know, if it's your If you're sore and chronically tight in your leg, does that mean something as opposed to being tight in your pelvic area?
I don't know. I mean, there's certain things that I feel very confident in speaking about where I'm like, yes, like this is a thing. If a person is afraid, it's very clear that there are physiological expressions, manifestations of fear. If a person is depressed, very clear. You know, you can, we're predominantly, when we're communicating, we're predominantly communicating with body language. Mm. You know, so there's a psychologist from the 60s called Albert Mehrabian. He came up with a thing called the 55-38-7 principle that you might have heard of, based off of your body language. You haven't heard of it, which is how we're communicating.
Okay.
Right. So the thing you just did with your eyes is like, oh, I never heard of that.
No.
That's how we're communicating.
Okay.
Right. Whereas you could have, there's, you know, several other gestures that you could have made with your eyes. It was just a little flick with your eyes. It was like, oh, she hasn't heard of that.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, how?
Oh. Yeah. I'm not a good liar. I could never lie my way
that's
out
great.
Of
anything. Yeah. Like that. So it's 55-38-7. He suggested through his research that 55% of our communication comes from body language. 38 is the tone of our voice. And then 7 is the actual words that we're speaking. And where that is relevant is if there is any disagreement between words, tone, body language, I would say it's over 93% of the time, but the suggestion is 93% of the time we're going to trust the tone and the body language of the person. And so the way that the person feels or emotes, it is expressed in the body. Where that comes back to kind of like some like the Louise Hay stuff and some other people that have gotten into that world of saying like, oh, your kidney is this and your liver is anger and your left whatever is your mother issues. I don't personally have like an embodied scientific lens on that. But I think it very clearly, if a person is chronically stuck in a state of bracing because maybe they were abused as a kid and maybe their father was an alcoholic. And maybe he would come home at night, the child was so deeply attuned to being able to hear the weight of his footsteps on the ground, or the way that he opened the door, or the way that he grabbed his keys. And it's like this sense of like, oh, this deep contraction, bracing, like, oh no, he's been drinking.
Wow.
That imprints so deeply.
Yeah.
And then from there, we either process those bracing patterns and compensatory strategies that we may have manifested from that, or we just keep on marching forward and we just keep on kind of buffering around that like tender part. You know, and I think that if a person is able to actually start to look at the body as more than just muscle ups and push ups and sprinting faster, and start to look at kind of some of like the I don't know, like the softer parts, I guess you could say, or like the intrinsic parts. I know that it translates to performance, obviously mental performance, cognitive performance. You like your head is in the game. If you're thinking about an ex-girlfriend or something like that, your head's probably not going to be in the game. Correct. If you're thinking about the fact that you just lost, you know, $20 million last night on for whatever reason, your head's probably not going to be in the game of life, whatever you're doing. Yeah. So being able to actually have practices and awareness of what's happening internally absolutely translates to externally. And you can very clearly see fear, sorrow, gratitude, happiness, all of that expressed in the body with the way that we hold ourselves. And typically the emotions that are the stickiest are the ones that hurt. You know, so if you were really afraid, if you were really depressed, you know, something really terrible, like a trauma happened, those are the things that go in and they stick because the body doesn't process it because it doesn't have the bandwidth to process it at that moment. And then that's what we call a trauma.
Yeah.
If you're able to, if something happens to you and you're like, oh, that sucked. Yeah. All right, well, let's, this is okay. Like I can process this. That's not a trauma. It's when it's like, this is so overwhelming that I can't bear this now. So I'm going to clock out, but the body will hold it. And then you march through your life, maintaining those intrinsic.
That items. Reminds me of a book called The Body Keeps the Score.
Yeah, Bessel van der Kolk. Yeah, I reference him a lot.
Yeah, that was really interesting because, so I work with elite athletes and I'm working at the level of like some of the best NBA players, Major League Baseball players. And what I see in them is they are ready for war. Meaning, you know, I get asked often, Louisa, well, these people, what do they have that other people don't have? And I really want everyone to understand that just because they're at that level, it doesn't mean that they got there just through their cardiovascular system or their skill set. Yes, of course, that you need to have the tactics of an NBA player. You need to have the skill set, but there's a lot more than that. There is so much more that goes into high performance that gets them to that level. And I think one of them that is completely misunderstood and underrated is understanding yourself. And in order to understand yourself, you have to go through, whether it's therapy, whether it's journaling every day, you have to go through that to be able to perform at your peak. So what does that look like? Well, for at NeuroAthletics, we do something called a bullshit journal, meaning that if you've got a racing mind at night, if something's happened to you during the day, you have full range to put it in your journal. It's a black journal, and it's only used for negativity. And that sounds kind of wild, right? But it's very therapeutic because you get 10 minutes to vent every single day. In that journal, you put down anything. My wife did this today. It really upset me. My coach did this today. It really got me mad. And you get it all out so you're able to sleep better. But what I find is that those who work on themselves and those who are going through a lot of the stuff that you've spoken about and that you've gone through are the ones who are able to be focused and be resilient and be in flow when they need to be. Mm.
Compared to suppressing through all the different mechanisms that we have to suppress. And I know that you wanted to, we talked about alcohol, which that's like a very, that's another sticky one. What do you think about suppressing or maybe not suppress, maybe that's too strong a language, just using alcohol in general? Are there different ways to use alcohol more or less effectively? Is there times of the day that's better or worse to drink alcohol?
So alcohol, I've put something out on Twitter recently, and on Instagram, and I said that no amount of alcohol is good for the brain. Now, it got a lot of backlash, and I'll tell you why. I think a lot of people self-medicate with a lot of alcohol, not just one drink. I'm talking they're moderate to chronic drinkers. And then they saw that as I've taken that away from them, you know, and everyone was trying to counteract what I was saying. No, that's not true. And they were saying, but what about the people who are living to 120 in Sardinia and in Greece? And what I do come from a science perspective. You know, I don't just say it because I've observed it. I say it because when you look at the studies and you see randomized control trials that have been done to show that moderate amounts of alcohol, which is classified as for women, 7 drinks a week. Now, this could be one drink a day, or it could be 7 drinks in one night, whatever that is.
Is there one that would be worse or better?
In terms of types of alcohol?
Yeah, one blowout, I got, you know, wasted every Saturday compared to I drink a glass of wine each night. My feeling is, I don't know, I guess is my thing.
No, I mean, I didn't look, it didn't go into that. It just came up with moderate amounts of alcohol. And somebody has asked me on a podcast, does it matter if you're doing 7 drinks of wine? I got to tell you that that's just an escape, because people keep bringing up resveratrol in red wine and we need to stop that. That's just silliness. And I won't go into that now, but 7 drinks and then 14 drinks for men. Now you think to yourself, that is classified as moderate. That's okay. So many women that I know that I see are drinking around 7 drinks a week. Okay. So it has now been shown that 7 drinks a week, classified as moderate drinking, is slowing the brain down. And it's also increasing atrophy of the brain. You are literally killing brain cells with this amount of alcohol. When I put that out there as a statement, people didn't like it. Now, I will say, if you have one drink, just like I say, if you have one donut, you're not going to get obese off one donut, and one drink probably won't affect you. However, it is the constant drinking. It's the same as finance. It's called compound interest. If you put $10 away every week, it's going to compound eventually. It's just the same as if you put 3 drinks away each week, into your system, it will compound over and over and over again. So alcohol is, unfortunately, I don't think it's good. I see it in the studies. I see it in the science. If we're looking at total brain health, brain volume, brain functionality, it doesn't serve a purpose in any way. So I think that anybody who is trying to perform at their peak should be steering clear of alcohol.
From your experience, this could be subjective. I don't know if there's any data on this, but what does loneliness do to the brain?
You know, I haven't looked at that. However, I will say that I interviewed Matt Kaepelin. He's a wonderful professor, and he's looking at longevity. He's really in that, lifespan and health span space. And he came on the podcast, and as we were closing out, it was like a 2-hour podcast. As we were closing out, he said that something that is not spoken about, something that people aren't even researching too much about, is loneliness and happiness. And he said that that is a huge proponent of longevity.
Yeah, the longest. So says the Harvard Happiness Study. It's the longest longitudinal study that's it's still running. I think it was 1936 that it started.
Yeah.
And they took a pretty wide, or a pretty large group of people. I don't remember the exact number of it. Followed them for the duration of their lives and also their offspring or their kids. And found through that the longest lever for longevity and overall health and well-being was the level of depth and meaning in people's relationships. They had meaningful relationships, you know, and that's...
Is that romantic or is that just friendships, business?
I don't remember if it specified romantic. I think it was just like you have tight-knit community.
I mean, look, because why? Because is it a serotonin? Is it a neurochemical thing that we're speaking about? Is it a... I am less stressed? Is it a cortisol thing? Is it an anxiety thing? Because anxiety can, you know, untreated anxiety can end up forming into depression. I'd love to understand more about that. I don't know, but I think that that's interesting.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Depends on how personal we're going to be.
How do you, when you experience emotions or feelings of like duress in your life, how do you tend to those sensations?
It's funny. I said this to Zach I had a podcast yesterday here in Austin as well. And we were talking about self-medicating with alcohol because I always try and find the root of, you know, why are you drinking? Does it taste good? And what you find in the literature is a lot of people self-medicate for stress. And that's never been me. I've never been a drinker, a smoker. Thankfully, it's never appealed to me. I would emotionally eat. I could eat an entire block of chocolate. I could eat a big block of Cadbury chocolate. I don't feel the need to, but if I'm really emotionally stressed, I think that I would turn to that. Yeah.
Is there a consistency of feelings or sensations that you historically have suppressed with eating, and feel free to be like, pass?
No, we don't have to pass. No, I look, nothing really traumatic other than my car accident. I do remember though in 2019, you know, living in New York and being far away from my family. I'm very close to my family. So it does give me a bit of, you know, it doesn't make me feel good being this far away from them. Now on New Year's Eve, I was ready to go out and I felt something was going on and my parents weren't answering the phone, and which is very odd. I'm like, what is going on? And my mom was trying to hold off not answering the phone until it hit midnight. And I got really upset and I said, you know, what's going on? And she mentioned that my dad had a stroke and he was in the hospital. And that feeling of being so far away and not going through that, was really horrifying. You know, it was traumatic for me. And it, you know, I was curled up in a ball in my room for about a week. It was, and I couldn't go back home. So it was a really hard thing for me to experience at that time.
Yeah. I'm just so, cause I believe particularly men, cause I identify as a guy, are experiencing more loneliness than what is spoken about. And particularly in relation to many people live alone, which that's not that normal in most parts of the world. Whereas Western culture, that's kind of the standard. You leave your parents' house by 18. If you're not, like, what are you doing? What's going on? And I feel like many people probably feel as though the rest of the world has this like illustrious lifestyle and community, and they're going to events, and they're just like this like full fulfillment type experience. And then it's just them. That's kind of like, huh, like it's, I'm not really.
Why did you say that men are feeling lonely?
I think men, typically, it's not as socially acceptable to express emotion. Whereas with women, it's more socially acceptable to like get together and, you know, get a bottle of wine or a bottle of non-alcoholic wine in your case, you know, and get some.
Whatever. I'll have a wine once every, you know, I actually average one glass of wine, I think, every 3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. So women do that. And I think women lean on each other in a really beautiful way. Like I recently was noticing some like emotional duress for myself and feeling of vulnerably reaching out to another male friend and saying like, hey bro, I need you. Like I could like use a person. Could we like go work out?
Is that correlated to the rates of depression in young men? I think I saw a statistic. So there was it was a statistic that came out just after Twitch, Ellen's host or DJ, after he committed suicide. And then it came out saying that men, depression rates and suicides are, don't quote me on this, but I think it was far more suicides in males.
Maybe it's middle-aged men. Yeah.
Yeah.
Middle-aged white men, I believe, which you'd think that that would be like, well, they're like the king. They're the problem.
That, that could be so controversial, right? Like, why is it? And it's really sad. And it draws, but you don't know where it's coming from. Is it due to substance abuse? Is it due to loneliness and not having an outlet to express their feelings?
I think it's mostly the outlet part. And I think it's the willingness to be vulnerable. I just recently did a podcast with Gabor Mate. Familiar with him? Yeah, he's great. We've done several together.
That's the book. He's the what's his book?
His most recent one is Myth of Normal. He's also done.
I just bought it.
Oh, good.
I can't believe you said that. You know why I bought it? He had a video that went viral, and somebody sent it to me. And the video was, no kids have the same parents. Meaning that, you know, I've got two older brothers, and they're both, you know, the eldest one is 10 years older than me and then 8 years older than me. And I always said to my parents, it's like we know our parents in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, and no one, they never agreed with me. I'm like, no, you guys were raised differently. We're raised in the exact same house by the exact same parents, but we were raised very differently.
Yeah.
And when he put that out there, that resonated with me. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the suggestion is much of your adult patterns manifest as a product of your life from 0 to 5 during those developmental years. And I'm sure that could be argued in various different directions. But something that I think that also can be kind of less easy to see is the idea of like, oh, like my parents were great. They never hit me. They provided food. They went to my soccer games. But something that I've experienced with myself going through therapy, I've been going through this like somatically based therapy, somatic experiencing type therapy for the last few months. And something that was uncovered for me was that my parents could only love me to the degree that they had access to loving themselves. And so my father grew up with an extremely abusive mother. She eventually became, you know, better, I guess, and just, you know, stopped that. But every Wednesday, I think it was, it was once a week, she would get drunk and like take out her aggression on him. And it was like a standard thing, like mark the calendar. And his dad would leave. And when he was gone at that date, she would be like, cool, like now I got you. And so he has never trusted emotional intimacy with a woman. And he's now 65 years old and like still processing this stuff. And my mom, she had her own set of things growing up. And so she learned that you need to be perfect. You know, so she has like this perfectionist thing, then kind of like a people pleaser type thing. And so within that, it's like me as a child, I wouldn't have had too much to complain about per se. I was never overtly abused. But as a child, to be able to feel that open-hearted connection with their parents and just feel that, like, cool, everyone can have a full exhalation.
Yeah.
Like, everyone feels at peace.
Yeah.
You know, like, wow, like, they're with me no matter what.
Yeah.
You know, whereas for me, my dad was, I don't know if he's an alcoholic, but he had issues with drinking and a lot of suppression. Mm. Never hit me, but wasn't able to be with his feelings. Mm. And so he would numb his feelings. And now here's me, this new little sponge in the world, being held by my father that's numbing himself because he's not able to bear what he feels. And me as a child, I'm receiving everything, you know, and then moving into the world, it's like, aha, here's me with my own issues of fear of commitment and my own issues of intimacy, because I don't want to be hurt. I don't want to be left. And I don't trust relationship. I don't think they're going to last.
Yeah.
And so I think that a lot of this is so much more covert and insidious than we realize.
Yeah.
And I think just being, just having vulnerable conversations is just, it's so invaluable. And I think for men generally, it's just less common.
Yeah. I have, I have somebody back in Australia who, she wrote a book and it's about self-mastery, and she mentioned something, you know, we were together and it was around Christmas time, and she was we were talking amongst us, and we heard that one of our friends is going through a divorce. And I said, oh, why are they going through a divorce? And somebody said, because was having an affair. The husband was having an affair. And I went, oh my gosh, that's horrible. And she goes, why are you acting as if that's such like crazy news? She said, that's just average now. Most people are somewhat having an affair. You know, I don't like to say that. It's like, but
it's almost like a coin flip statistically.
Okay. And so why is it becoming more, I wouldn't even say acceptable. Why is it becoming more less shocking? I know the divorce rate is getting higher. So why is it becoming more frequent that men or women are choosing to have affairs?
Probably unmet needs and not feeling safe to actually communicate their needs. I would say probably be a starting point. It's definitely way out of my realm of expertise. And I'm way better talking about like squats and spinal health.
Yeah, we've really gone deep on emotional health. Sammy, we never speak. This is a science-based podcast. I'm here. I am spitting like emotions. But
I think a lot of it is not feeling probably seen and heard by our partners. But then a part of that as well is you can only feel seen and heard to the degree that you can see and hear yourself.
That's why I asked you that question. Yeah.
And so I think, and then where it gets sticky again is when instead of actually reflecting back of like, what's my role in this relationship? You know, I obviously attracted you for some reason. You know, you could even maybe say like, I've created certain relationships in my life, or whatever language you want to use. There's something about that person. Maybe you intentionally attracted an unavailable person because you don't want someone to actually press the buttons to go into those deeper layers within yourself because you're terrified.
Yeah.
And so, cool. All right. I'm going to find someone that's maybe a little abusive or maybe a little disconnected or maybe a little distant,
yeah.
You know, and I'm going to find someone that's probably going to leave me because that's home.
Yeah. Wow. That's super scary. And so the guys are listening, and we'll wrap this portion up. But I think what I was trying to get at is I see a lot of people saying, I want to be ultra successful. I want to be at the top of my game. But they're neglecting to really work on the core pillars, which is literally at the bottom of the pyramid.
Oh, yeah.
And one of them, apart from sleep, exercise, nutrition, which is the three pillars we work on in your athletics. Apart from that, it is emotional health. It's
why is a person getting jacked and getting money and getting success? It's typically to enhance their relationships. If you pull the relationships out of the equation, like what do you really have? You're just going to be repetitively shooting hoops all day just for the sake of yourself.
Yeah.
Like it's not for you.
No.
You don't love basketball or money that much. It's about the relationships that will manifest as a product of investing all of yourself and all of this work into this. But if you're just investing in the thing that hypothetically creates the relationship without actually investing in the relationship itself and not investing in a relationship with yourself, then you just have a bunch of skills and probably a deep feeling of disfulfillment. if that's a word. Is disfulfillment a word? Unfulfillment.
Unfulfillment. So yeah, then to wrap this up, what would be the action items?
I mean, I think therapy is so valuable.
But finding the right therapist is not easy.
I think find a person that's really into therapy and really into these things and talk to them and say, who's a good therapist? And I think particularly finding someone that works more somatically based. So the examples would be like the Hakomi method would be something someone could look up, or somatic experiencing would be something. And what happens within that is you're actually, the therapist is guiding you into feeling more deeply into your body. This is like Bessel van der Kalk stuff. Or Peter Levine is another example of that. He wrote the book Awakening the Tiger. He created somatic experiencing. And so if you find someone that's able to guide you into those parts of yourself from a somatic lens, or like an embodied way, the body has so much to share. It has so much information. It's like so much more vast than a person would think. And we could jump back into the brain realm, because many people are living up in their heads and they have these illustrious stories of who they are. And maybe you could talk to a therapist and get all these stories of, oh, this is my mom did this and they did that. But you still have this 30, 40, 50 year old contraction and bracing pattern held in your body. And so if you can find someone that's able to support with that, I think that that's invaluable. Maybe doing like an extended sit of some sort, doing some type of like meditation practice. You could do like small ones, but bigger blocks are really impactful. There's like Vipassana meditation. It's a 10-day experience. There's things called, this is going way out at the end. It might turn off some people listening, but like a darkness retreat is a thing that I just recently did. That sounds completely ridiculous. But what it does is you're sitting alone with yourself in a dark room for anywhere from like 3 to 10 days. Mine was 4 days and 5 nights. And someone brings you food each day in a little like dark box thing, so light doesn't come in. You get your whole food for the whole day. And then you just sit with yourself the whole time. There's nothing to do. No distractions. Sounds insane.
Yeah. It sounds something that's going to send me into therapy.
But so what happens with that, and we really can wrap this up, but what happens with that is it strips away all the compensatory distractive patterns that you could have had. You can't drink the alcohol. You can't scroll through Instagram. You can't do any of the things. So many of us, we have a feeling build up. Oh, it's a little uncomfortable. And then we reach for the cell phone. Okay, I'll check my email. Oh, I'll just like kind of space out on YouTube. Oh, I'll just watch whatever I watch. You know, oh, I'm going to drink some alcohol. I already said that. And then what we're doing with that is I think we're just delaying the body's deeper messages where it's saying like, hey, bro, we have some stuff to work on. It might be really old. It might not be that old. Yeah. There's some stuff here. And it's learning and respecting the language of the body, which it expresses itself not with words, but with feelings. Oh, I feel anxious. Oh, why? Oh, I feel kind of depressed. I feel, you know, all of that. So I think listening into that, not shaming oneself about feeling those sensations, that's another issue.
No, I think that's really important.
It's not talked about a lot.
No, it's definitely not.
And especially in the realm of science, because science is a lot of analytics and it's measurable and it's repeatable, you know, but a person's pain to the point where maybe self-harm or you know, suppression of the feelings, whatever it is. How do we measure that?
Well, there's something now called PNE, pain neuroscience education, where somebody's ability to be able to describe pain to somebody, because nothing, you know, people are chronically in pain and no amount of painkillers is helping them. And so there's this whole new field in neuroscience called PNE. So the patient can understand what pain is in order to get over that pain.
What do you think of the biopsychosocial of pain? We're back in the, are you familiar with this?
I'm not, no.
Bio, biology, psycho, psychology, social, like relationship with the world. There's the Laramir Mosley he's someone I've done a podcast with. He's like one of the kind of preeminent thought leaders in that. There's several other folks in that realm. But essentially, it's the way that it's pain not being just an acute, like nociceptive thing.
Is he Australian?
Yeah, he's your guy.
I know him.
He's amazing. You should have him on the podcast.
I bought one of his books.
Oh, good.
And it was about understanding pain neuroscience.
I think it has like a homunculus.
It has a homunculus. Right? It's colored. It's got a binder.
Let's get back down to brass tacks. What the heck's a homunculus?
Yeah.
What do we need to know about pain? What do you think of Laramir Moseley and the biopsychosocial of pain? Which defining, I think, I don't know, this might not be a great definition, but the way that our social structure and our psychology and perception affects our experience with pain. Because a lot of pain isn't just, oh, I got a cut. You know, when you get into like chronic pain or fibromyalgia, places like that.
Well, that's what I was talking about. It's that chronic pain where people need to understand what they're going through. You know, you get people going back and forth. Like, what's the current population taking a prescription drug for pain? Yeah. It's the same as an SSRI.
Yeah.
You know, it's just going up.
They're suppressing the feeling.
Suppressing whatever it is. Although, don't get me wrong, there is a place for an antidepressant, evidently. I was even looking into the statistics of the U.S. population. I think it's around 8 to 10% now are taking prescription sleep medication because they can't sleep.
Yeah.
They're having trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. So it's the same with pain. And there is like this subspecialty now in neuroscience and neurology, which is there solely meant to explain to a patient what pain is, because sometimes it turns out that this is why this field is, you know, now emerging. It turns out that sometimes patients aren't really having pain. It's because they've been telling themselves that they are in pain so much that they believe that they're in pain, that they believe their pain is real. And that's why when they self-medicate with prescription drugs, they say it doesn't work. Isn't that scary?
Yeah. Yeah. That's like John Sarno's work, the mind over back pain guy.
Do you just spend your entire life reading?
I've been doing the podcast for almost 8 years. So I've spent like a lot, like when people ask me about movies and things, I'm like, I have no idea. Music, I like music, but I don't like know the names of the people. When someone's like, do you know about this book? I'm like, before they say it, I'm like, I think so.
Yeah.
So I'm into authors and such, but that's the suggestion within the book is like, you read the book, you understand what this pain, this chronic pain is. And through your understanding of what it is, you start to reinterpret that information. You kind of lessen the signal a bit. And suddenly your body's like, suddenly this input isn't so dangerous anymore. Mm. Whereas before I thought it was dangerous.
Yeah.
So I amplified it.
Yeah.
Now I have this different perception of it that reduced the danger, a greater understanding. Mm-hmm. And now suddenly it's like, the whole system down regulates and like,
And I don't feel the pain as much.
I'll be darned.
Where the pain was a 10 out of 10. Now it's a 6 out of 10.
Yeah.
And if I keep practicing this, it'll be a 2 out of 10.
And then the other thing across the board that is the most effective for reducing pain, from my understanding, is movement. Do you know anything about this realm of like addressing pain through movement or just any techniques or practices, or if someone...
Oh, let's explore them together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's something that if a person is experiencing some type of shoulder pain or something like that, it's, you don't want to perpetuate the pain signal. So you want to kind of back out of the pain, but be going as close to it as possible and creating new safe terrain. So exploring new safe terrain with your nervous system through movement without actually repeating that pain signal.
Okay, so let's break it down. Person who has a cold shoulder, and by they've got a frozen shoulder, whatever we want to call it.
Yeah.
Then
I like cold shoulder. That's so much nicer. That's
I don't know how I'll say cold shoulder. But basically, that means what you're saying is a lot of people shy away from. Okay, I'm not going to do a movement involving the rotator cuff because I don't want to irritate that. But what you're saying is move into it by doing little exercises.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
you got to engage it. There was research done. I don't remember where this came from, but I bet you've heard of this. The researchers taped together a monkey's two fingers, and they could actually map that in the brain before in the homunculus. You'd see like there's the index, there's the middle.
Yeah.
You tape those fingers together, it becomes one finger in the brain.
Yes. Yes.
You lose a finger.
Yeah.
Because you stop moving it.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
So this is what happens to the brain. And I want everyone to really hear me strong with this. Back to the homunculus. So there is a representation in your brain. So every single part of your brain, you know, is involved with something different in your body. You've got the motor cortex, which sits kind of like where our earphones are. That's what it's pretty much looks like, motor cortex. And you've got different areas of your brain which are responsible for hand movement, sensory movement, kicking your leg, everything, okay? As we age, we stop doing certain things in life. And when we stop doing that, you know, things that that area of your brain is responsible for, it starts to atrophy. And through the process of neuroplasticity, which is an amazing thing, basically meaning that your brain can be rewired and due to different experiences and different actions. That's why they call the brain plastic. So if it keeps going down a certain path, back to the strapping of the fingers, your index finger and your middle finger, if you act as if this is one finger, it sends the signal to your brain that I'm just using this as one finger. And therefore, just like evolution, monkey into man, it develops a pattern of this is just one finger. Mm.
So how do we, this is still running kind of a similar trend of back to the realm of pain and emotional pain and sensation. A lot of the emotional pain that we feel is habitual. If you were really to take an audit of one's thoughts throughout the day, you know, what do they say? It's like 80-odd% the same kind of consistent patterns. You know, it's been the same for the last 3 months. It's been the same for the last 6 months. It's like to start to realign some of the ruts that we've created, like stinking thinking, is very meaningful to actually have some leverage or have some autonomy and be able to take control of that. Is that something that we could be, how do you change a person's habits? It could be from a movement perspective as well, because that's what you do with people with the neuroathletics. You know, you might have, like, what do you think about that? Habit forming, habit changing, neuroplasticity. Mm. You have any thoughts on that?
So, yeah, I look at everything, whatever habit you want to change, treat it as an addiction and take into consideration dopamine, which is the molecule that's involved with motivation, goal setting, drive. It's that thing that keeps pushing you forward. If you have a bad habit, let's just say that you're on Instagram and you're just dopamine, you know, you're just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, and you are constantly just draining your dopamine system. You're just draining it. Go on a dopamine fast. And this is, I learned this from Anna Lemke. She's a psychiatrist. She came on my podcast and she mentioned that in order to break a habit, primarily she was talking about addiction, okay? But let's just say that we're treating habits like addiction. Go on a fast from that habit. So if it is scrolling on TikTok, you've got to go cold turkey. Mm. And she mentions that hers is for a month. I say go cold turkey for 2 weeks on whatever habit that is. And be deliberate with whatever habit you want to replace it with. If it is, I want to become healthier, or I want to go to make it a deliberate effort. A lot of people, what I'm finding is people are just waiting for life to just be handed to them. Mm. Like, oh, you're just going to magically walk into a healthy body. You're going to magically walk into a great physique or great health or whatever it is that you're looking for. I don't believe that anything in 2023 comes easy. It has to be deliberate. So if you want to have a better performing brain or a better performing body, it has to be a deliberate effort. So if it is breaking that habit, it's going to be hard. Just know that. Go cold turkey for 2 weeks, replace it with something and be deliberate about it. Every single morning, set yourself a goal. I will go out and walk and get sunshine for 20 minutes at 7 a.m. every morning.
Yeah.
Just say 2 weeks. That's it.
I wonder from you, how does a person start to integrate some of the concepts that you teach in neuroathletics with an S, plural, into one's daily life? Is there a way that a person could be developing their visual function or vestibular function or coordination, hand-eye, like all of that stuff, just through life? Or do you have to have like a training center?
No, that's the beautiful thing about it. I I would say about in 2016, I read this incredible study. And this was pretty much, I wouldn't say the birth of neuroathletics. The birth of neuroathletics was around 2014. But in 2016, I read this beautiful study, and it was printed in Nature, and it was a study that was done where they took a group of adults and they got them to juggle, which is why I got so excited to see that you could juggle today. And they gave them three balls, and they got them juggling for 12 weeks. And they also got them doing other things such as throwing the ball to the wall, just a tennis ball. And they were doing many things with, it's called open skills and open training and open and closed skills training. And basically what they found was that they did MRI scans and showed that they grew the gray matter of their brain over that 12-week period.
Where's the brain?
Oh, everywhere. It was the gray. It was
the whole thing just got.
It was, yeah, they saw a thicker lining, which just blew my mind, because I was thinking, oh my gosh, I was already doing work and research into the vision, you know, into the visual system and seeing how that correlates to the brain. But when I saw that, what the hell, it's thicker, that really intrigued me. And so that was the birth of a lot of our drills, which, you know, people listening can go and watch on YouTube or on Instagram. Aaron and I did some awesome drills today. Anyone can do them. You just need a set of neuro balls, or you can just get tennis balls. And all you do is just practice throwing the ball to the wall. It sounds so simple, but some of the most beautiful things in life are the simplest things.
Yeah.
Some of the best inventions, multi-billion-dollar inventions, are the most simple inventions.
Yeah, and like it's also only simple until you try to devise a robot to do it. And then you're like, oh, this is complex.
Yeah, yeah.
A person being able to have the articulation to be able to hold the ball and throw with the wrist and then process visually where is it at and then respond. And there's like, it's like a whole storm
but
happening within that process.
People think, well, Louisa, what can I achieve with just throwing the ball to the wall? Let me tell you, there is so much involved in that. You've got, first and foremost, you've got gripping and cupping with your wrist. You've got reaction time. Okay. You've got stimulus. If everybody's listening to this, you've got the frontal lobe of your brain houses the prefrontal cortex. And the way I like to do it is you put your hand just here and behind. And if everyone's, you know, not listening, if you're listening on audio, you just get your hand, you put it up on your forehead, just behind there lives your prefrontal cortex. It's the CEO of the brain. And this is where decision-making, information processing speed, reaction time, that's where that lives. And over time, it diminishes. You know, as we get older and as we, you know, lose, you know, as we stop doing things, it diminishes. But if you can practice this, that's, you're training your prefrontal cortex. You're training your visual system. You need to know, you've thrown the ball at a trajectory, let's just say at a 45-degree angle, but it bounces and it's coming off 90 degrees. I don't know if I got that right. But what I'm trying to say is it's coming off at a different angle. So you not only have to see it, you have to react to it. So you have to move in a different plane. You have to move maybe horizontally. You maybe have to move vertically. And you also have to cup it at the right angle. So there's so much involved in this most simplest task that has so many variations.
Yeah.
At Neuroathletics, we've come up with over 500 variations, which is absolutely ludicrous, but we have. And that is the starting point. Let me tell you, I have worked with the world's best NBA players and player. I still do. And I get, before he goes on the court, I am doing these drills. People think that these, you know, these amazing players are doing something so crazy in the back room before they go onto the court. I know what they're doing because I've been there and I'm doing this with them. And I guarantee if you do it, you'll fire up your nervous system, central nervous system, peripheral nervous system. It's just such an amazing thing.
How does a person develop greater neuroplasticity? I know listening to Huberman, he's talked about making mistakes is quite meaningful. You know, so if you're just doing the same repetitive action over and over again, you have nothing, you're like, oh yeah, I know what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
There's not really much reason to change with that. I'd imagine the process of doing some of the exercises that you do with throwing balls and catching and all of that stuff, it's littered with mistakes, you know, and it's littered with novelty. So within that, I presume there would be an immense amount of neuroplastic potential.
Yeah.
by doing an activity like that compared to, say, like a bicep curl that you've done maybe 6,000 reps of. Are there other ways, and please elaborate on that, but like, how does a person start to leverage neuroplasticity for themselves?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to understand what you're trying to achieve. Neuroplasticity works with everything after a repeated amount of times. If you do something wrong repeatedly, you're going to get used to that, but you're building neuroplasticity. So the first step is to really get the movement of whatever you're trying to do right. That's why I always say it's really important to work with a trainer, someone who knows what they're doing. Don't just go into the weights room and do a squat if you don't know how to do it.
Film yourself too.
You can film yourself. Make sure you've got that down plan. Here's the second part that I think that people are misunderstanding as well. Learning, which is part of the neuroplasticity process, learning takes place in two parts. It's the actual movement or the actual action, okay, of learning. And then it takes place during sleep. Mm-hmm. So you're getting the penetration of whatever you learn during sleep. That's why sleep is fundamentally the most underrated high performance tool that we have. So if you aren't sleeping and you're hoping to achieve whatever it is that you're trying to achieve through the process of neuroplasticity, then you're just kidding yourself.
What are the mistakes people are making with sleep?
Oh, number one is they're going to bed at the wrong time. Thinking that, well, Louisa, I'm an entrepreneur. I can get up. I don't have a boss. I can go to bed at 1 and I'll sleep until 9. I'm getting my 8 hours. Wrong. That's incorrect, because we know now that we have a circadian rhythm, which is in line with a 24-hour clock. We all have that. So we know when the sun rises and the sun's setting. It turns out that there is a particular area in the brain, Huberman's talked about this, which is involved in producing dopamine. And it turns out that if this area has access to light, meaning that if your eyes are open between the hours of 10 p.m. and 4 a.m., it's going to suppress this little area in the brain that is responsible for producing dopamine. So therefore, if you go to bed, if you're watching TV, if you've got lights on, if you're looking at your phone screen at between the hours of 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. So let's just say you're up until 1 a.m. and you're looking at these lights, you're not going to get that dopamine release in the morning. And we all need that.
So dopamine release in the morning. So you're like up and at them.
So you're vigilant, you're excited, you can get up out of bed.
And so then you'll have addictive behavior throughout the day.
Correct.
Because you're trying to return yourself back to baseline.
Yeah, and you won't have that dopamine release. So pretty much you're not giving yourself a head start. You get up in the morning and you're already lost a bit. You're already not winning.
What about a person that is getting up throughout the middle of the night? I think if a person has trouble falling asleep, it probably comes back more to like emotional stuff. Or also just having crummy patterns. Maybe you ate a big meal before you went to bed, or maybe you're exposed to a bunch of blue light or agitation of whatever sort. What if you're consistently getting up at 4 a.m. every morning?
Which is actually not uncommon for men around the age of 70. Most men tend to get up, and look, a lot of women too have trouble sleeping as we get older. And here's the thing, you have to assess why you're getting up. Are you getting up because you're tired, or because you just wake up and you just don't feel like you can sleep anymore and you've got insomnia? Are you getting up because you heard a loud noise, or are you getting up to go to the toilet? So there's many different things that happens. But regardless, if you get up and you switch on a light, you've lost the game. Don't even think that you're going to go back to sleep. It's going to be extremely hard for you because your brain has then signaled, oh, I'm awake. I'm going to start the engines and it's ready to go. So that's the worst thing you can do. A lot of times what's happening is people are just running out of melatonin. And that's just what's jolting them out of bed. Melatonin is the naturally secreting hormone that gets secreted in response to darkness, and it puts us into sleep. And sometimes we sleep with the light, with the, what do you call them? Curtains, the curtains open, light gets in, wakes us up. And we think, how did that happen?
Is light going to be the main catalyst affecting the either upregulation or downregulation of melatonin?
Yeah.
The factors in that? Oh, what about 100%. Like taking exogenous melatonin or things of that sort?
Yeah. But also taking exogenous melatonin can deplete that system as well.
Yeah, right.
So, but light is probably the the biggest thing. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder, so day-to-day life you are going through, is there anything you can do at your home without like a tennis ball or something of the sort to be stimulating vestibular function, visual function, things of the sort, like doing visual saccades or going through like smooth pursuits or some of that stuff? I think could be a little dorky in a way. You know, it's like for a person, it's like, could you hypothetically just go for a walk and look up in the trees?
Yeah.
You know, and change your use myopic vision, look up close, you know, use panoramic, take it out. Like, do we need to be so structured with that? Or are we kind of structuring our lives to offset a general deficit that we have in a modern lifestyle where we're not just taking a walk in the woods enough?
No, honestly, I'm really happy you brought that up. Nature is incredible. You can be walking outside and already you can get a massive relief from depressive like symptoms. We know that through forward ambulation, you're walking outside, you're having, you're telling your brain, just when you're walking forward, it signals to your brain through forward ambulation that you are moving forward.
Yeah, progress.
Yeah. And that means I'm doing well, because moving forward is correlated to I'm doing well and I'm progressing in life. But it's the same. So that's one aspect. But in terms of visual system, going out and seeing new things, and you can make it interesting. Try and spot something blue. You just like keep looking around everywhere in a forest that's just full of green. Try and spot something red, and you look around and you can end up finding something, but it's really hard. But you end up finding something. Or just try and notice the leaves and the patterns in the leaves and describe them. Try and look at things that you just never really intrinsically look at.
What is that? The reticular activating system?
Oh, yeah.
Is that kind of like that a little bit? You look for things.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So it's looking for danger typically.
Yeah, the RAS is basically saying to yourself, it happens to me all the time. We don't have many Teslas in Australia. Well, we do now, but you know, 2 years ago we didn't, but we did here. And I used to think, wow, I'm so excited about the Tesla. I want to see a Tesla. And then I would just see them everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely everywhere. Which is like the same thing with negativity. You'll see it. If that's what you really believe about the world, you'll see negativity in everyone.
It's so amazing. That's like the pictures of the vase or vase, depending upon how you say that, and the two faces. You've seen that before? There's various different pictures like that.
Yeah.
Where it's like, if you see two faces, you can't stop seeing two faces. It's just two faces.
Yeah.
The moment that you flip your perception to, it's a white vase. Mm-hmm. The faces are gone.
Yeah.
We're doing that all the time.
All the time. 100%.
Yeah. And so I think that that's like just coming back into awareness of having autonomy and power over our decision-making, I think is just so invaluable.
Yeah. Sorry to cut you off, but it just reminded me, I speak about Alzheimer's disease a lot. Currently, 50 million people worldwide suffer from Alzheimer's disease, and that number is said to triple by the year 2050. One thing that we don't speak about a lot is that Alzheimer's disease robs you of many things, but the one thing it robs you of is your mind in terms of being able to decide. That is diminished. Being able to remember, being able to just sit down and have, you know, memory. Imagine feeling like you sat down, you're having a conversation, and somebody says, but we just had this conversation. Like it's robbing you of your identity, of who you are. That's why these practices are so important. You have to deliberately practice in your 30s and in your 40s and in your 50s. Just because you're in your 30s, this is when these disease states start. Yeah. They start to accumulate, and you don't get the symptoms until your 60s. So starting to incorporate patterns into your life that is training decision-making, that's training processing speed, that's training memory. You and I did those today. You were training everything. We even did word fluency. We did addition and subtraction. I don't think we did subtraction, but I know we did addition. So you're taking numerical ordering into play. Like we were doing things that you didn't do.
Yeah, there's some research from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and that's you've probably heard of this as well. The they have all of the different practices or modalities that they went through to prevent cognitive decline. They found in that research, I believe, dance to be the longest lever for it. Because that's, I mean, you're doing all the neuroathletic stuff. You're going through all the coordination. I think there's also something to coordinating yourself with movement, which I'd imagine you probably use sound as well. You'd probably have to. We didn't do sound today, but I imagine you do that. But then the other element of that is it's...
We do taste as well.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That's great. But the other element of that is the emotional component. Because if you're dancing, especially if you're dancing with someone else, or if you're dancing alone, but people might be watching... How does the emotional element affect neurology? Because a lot of the research, and you might just not have a response for this, because a lot of the research would be in a pretty like sterile environment, I'd imagine. How do you feel like life infuses into one's neurology and like the difference between dancing with a partner compared to doing some standing one foot and, you know, throwing tennis balls up against a wall?
I actually don't have an answer for that.
What do you think?
What do I think? I mean, do you know, as in like, can your brain respond to dancing? Does it respond to dancing?
The emotional component particularly. Like, because there's not a lot of emotional investment in a situation where, I mean, it might be, maybe you don't want to fail or something.
Yeah.
But particularly the emotional component of people are watching me. Like it's raising a certain level of like stress in the body, or try, or maybe it's like love connection with a partner. You know, so there's like this intimacy that's happening. So it's like, cool, we have our five senses, you know, we're seeing, we're smelling, we're tasting. That sensation of connection with a person, like intimacy that you could feel with a person in tandem with an exercise, you know, or dance. I don't know. You don't need to have a response for it. It's just an interesting thing.
It actually reminds me that you get a greater ability to learn a task when there's more of emotion involved.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I have to add to that.
That's a huge thing.
This guy just keeps going with the emotions. My community is probably thinking, what? She doesn't talk about emotions.
How do you feel about it? Are you like, do you feel like, oh, people aren't going to like this emotional stuff? Or do you feel like,
I think that every time I put out something emotional, people are like, people love it.
We should cry.
And, people are like, oh, she's not a robot. And she has emotion.
Why do you think that people have perceived you that way? Or you have perhaps, like why do you think that is?
I'm trying my best with my brand to give everybody what they want. I don't believe that everyone's here because they're interested in Louisa. Because I got to tell you, I'm not very exciting. I just do monotonous things all day. So I don't think you're here thinking, I want to see what she's up to. Like, what's she wearing today? I never wear fashion's definitely not my thing. So they're definitely not following me for fashion or my makeup or anything like that, or my hair, for God's sake. So they're here for one purpose, and that is to understand how to have a better performing brain. So I don't think that people really care too much about how I'm feeling, even though I'm feeling great.
Really? Come on. Get the heck out. People don't care about how you're feeling.
I mean, like,
if people follow your stuff and they're listening to your stuff, my guess is probably people would be like, I'd imagine it would probably closen. Is closen a word?
Yeah, I guess so.
Closen? I think it would
make closen the fact. Yeah, I don't know. But what I mean is, you see now on social media, like, I'm following people, and sometimes I think, why am I following you? I don't care about your, like, what your puppy is doing.
Yeah.
And then I think, I'm not going to go and put up, you know, I did give a glimpse into my life. I went overseas to Europe in September. It was my best friend's wedding, and you know, I was MC. And so I did 2 weeks of just no brain content, just this is my life, family, I should, everything. I lost like 2,000 followers. Because people are like, this girl's overseas, she's partying, she's having fun in Greece. I don't, why am I following her? I'm following her for brain content.
Could have been a coincidence as well. You know, things happen. Algorithms change. I want to ask another question.
I do know a lot of those people were vegans because I did put up
aha, that was it.
It was
that,
the vegan.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't talk about The only way I talk about meat is in supporting regenerative farming, which I think is very important.
Do you eat meat?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you're not a vegan.
I'm like pretty animal-based.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I wouldn't have. That was definitely a shift. I've kind of followed the trend a little bit, but I'm definitely not. Like, I pretty much eat like a big salad every day. And in that salad, I usually put like a pound of meat, typically with some organs in it as well.
Oh, and
then a bunch of different veggies and whatnot. I get like an organ blend.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good.
Like liver.
Like all stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. I also take some organ supplements. But a question I have as well around emotional health / cognitive health / longevity is, what about orientation of eyes? Because your eyes are continuous to central nervous system and neurological tissue, and you're going looking up, that has an effect. When you're looking down, that has an effect. EMDR therapy that comes as a product of going for a walk outside. I don't remember the woman's name that founded it, but the idea came from like, wow, when I'm taking a walk outside and I'm scanning the horizon, it seems like it's like processing something.
Mm-hmm. Emotional traumas.
Yeah, like it goes in there.
It goes in, which is why what is that thing called that just keeps going back, the lights?
Oh, I don't know. Pendulum?
No. It's an actual...
Oh, I've never done it before. Okay, I've just heard about it.
It is EMDR.
EMDR?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's EMDR, that's the thing. I just don't know, like the light box or whatever it's called. Yeah, so is there anything from your understanding of neuroscience, effects of orientation and position of the eyes, such as looking up, being supportive for like energy and creativity, looking down, kind of sending the signal that it's time to rest, or you know, looking up diagonally. I know that there's some stuff around I think in neurolinguistic programming they have a
if you look up to the right, you're lying.
Looking up to the right, yeah, I think it's generally just if you're looking up, it's like creative thinking. Yeah. And if you're looking down, you're like, you're processing implicit information.
Yeah, correct. Yeah,
what do you think about all that?
No, I am in complete agreeance with that, and here's why. One of the aspects of what we do is visual acuity testing, and we take in 20 different metrics within that when we train our athletes. So we use an EEG, a hospital grade EEG, to assess visual acuity. So we are assessing the speed at which your eye sees a stimulus, and then we're testing the optic nerve. The optic nerve is the nerve that, it's a cranial nerve, and it's a nerve that connects your eye pretty much to your brain. And that's how we process information. Obviously, it goes through to the occipital cortex, comes back to the prefrontal cortex, and it makes a decision on what that stimulus is. We're testing the rate of that. And what I have found, it's tested and you get a P100 score. What I've found is that we can use that measurement, and then we can train different we can train the brain, okay, for that speed to get faster. And the way we train it is through different diagonal positions. So you can be getting an athlete. What we can do is we can block his left eye completely. Block it out. Let's just say you've got an eye patch over your eye, and just test him in going into all different planes of his eye, all different planes, literally in a 360 degree motion. And you can strengthen different parts of your brain just by doing that.
Mm. Do you know anything about the myopia? I don't know if you call it an epidemic. A lot of people are myopic these days.
They are.
One of the things that's interesting with that,
especially
is
in their thinking.
Yeah. Well, and that's once again, it's like your eyes are your brain.
Yeah.
You know, and when we're perceiving fear, you know, our pupils adjust for that. When we're relaxed, our pupils adjust. When we're in myopic focused, that's going to be more executive function, like get stuff done. When we tap into zooming out, really relax the ciliary muscles and, you know, accommodate to go into this, taking the whole scene in, that's going to send a signal to the autonomic nervous system that's like, cool, Louisa must be chilling. Mm-hmm. She's taking in the whole scene. I had a question. I got all excited about talking about all the different directions of what the eyes do. Is there any other stuff that we can do to tap into the way that we feel with our visual muscles from your perception?
I wouldn't know about how you feel, but if anybody's looking at training, you know, their visual system at home as well, I know you're asking about what can we do in nature. And apart from the ball skills, there's a wonderful, you know, simple exercise where you print out a photo of a circle. Okay. Print it out from your computer, stick it on the wall, and then print out other circles and a bit smaller and put them in different areas around that. And you can just go from the big circle and go down and just like with your eye, follow it, go to the little circle and then come back up to the big circle, go to the little circle, come back up to the big circle, and keep doing that in different planes. And you'll train the different projections of your eye and the different angles.
That was a question I had not that exactly, but it came to me. The epidemic, if we could call it that, of myopia, becoming nearsighted. One suggestion within that, that's what I was suggesting, the ciliary muscles doing the contraction, all that stuff, to focus your vision in, that's actually a muscular contraction.
Yeah.
Right? You're changing the shape of the lens to refract that light. And then when you're relaxing into panoramic vision, you're going in and you're relaxing the eyes essentially. Another part of that I've read about that I don't know a lot about is exposure of sunlight to the eyes being supportive for actually changing the shape of the eyes. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts around why people are becoming myopic at pretty staggering rates?
Well, that's pretty much because what we've seen is that to get these effects, in terms of if we're going into more of a myopic state, right? That means that we're going backwards. Okay. So atrophy, not too much atrophy, but we're not getting access to sunlight to the amount that we need. And the amount that we need is around 3 hours per day. Now, I put this out there. It's really funny that you said this. I put this out there on Twitter saying that about, the epidemic of myopia and sunlight. And I got a lot of backlash from people saying, Louisa, how dare you? I'm working on Wall Street. There's no way I can get 3 hours of sunlight per day. But I think that that's the reason why we are narrowing our vision, staring too much at a screen instead of staring outside and going outside and looking at everything around us to get our benefit and to get our pleasure and to get our dopamine. We're finding it on this tiny little screen. We're looking at the television, and then we're also at work just staring at a screen as well.
Yeah.
When we're with our partners, our spouses, we're staring at a screen. We're not going out and doing things such as hiking. So it's no wonder that this is happening.
Yeah, it's such a wild thing when you think your eyes are literally your brain peeking out of your head.
Yeah.
And you have the effect to, in a way, massage your brain just by going through these various different forms of visual accommodation, which means like changing the lens to affect the way the light hits. You can literally be going through movement patterns. Like you're moving the brain itself. That's like an odd concept. I think we think of the brain as being something that's like, it's inside this vacuum. Yeah. It's inside this container.
Yeah.
And so to be able to affect our cognitive function, in fact, maybe like mental clarity, affect creativity, so if you are continually staring into a screen throughout the day, I don't know enough about any data on that. I know I've read lots of things around it. I don't have anything to say about it right now, but it just intuitively makes sense to me that would have massive implications.
Well, I think we need to look at it as if like, what are the negative effects of myopia on an emotional standpoint? And I don't know that.
Yeah.
But I think that that's a really interesting area.
Yeah. And a person, like a lot of the people, and we can wrap up soon, a lot of the people, most creative people in the world, they get their ideas from taking a walk outside.
Every morning I go for a walk. It's my thing. If I'm walking to the gym, that's my walk. I live in New York, so walking to the gym is quite a lengthy thing. But I walk to the gym or I just go for my morning walk. And for some reason, I get all of my creative thinking done. I'm like, oh, that's amazing. And as soon as I get to my desk, I get straight to my desk in my office and I forget everything. I'm like, what did I just think of? And I think to myself, is it because I've had blood flow to the brain? Because it happens when I'm at the gym as well. I get excited. I think, oh my God, this is just BDNF. This is blood flow. This is nutrients, oxygen to my brain. That's why I'm thinking this way. But it's not. I experience something different. I experience more creativity during a walk than what I do going to the gym.
What do you think, what does the brain do? The brain receives information, processes information and then creates an output. So while
it's meaning.
And so while if you think of like what your skin and your connective tissue and your fascia and your organs and all of the different parts, you know, how many sensory receptors are interlaced throughout the rest of the system. So if you are upregulating the amount of information to process in the form of varied textures, varied temperatures, it's really hot outside, maybe now you're sweating, maybe you are, it's novelty of the environment, there's a dog walking by, there's cars, compared to the complete lack of stimuli sitting in the same dang room that you've been every day, 5 days a week or whatever, for however long, with the same, you know, lights that are, they're going through, you know, it's alternating current. So it's like flipping quite fast, you know, which is a little like irritating compared to that direct current that you're getting from the sun. It's like this soothing sensation. You know, it's just, but it's, we're in very sterile environments that lack stimuli. And so it would only make sense that if you upregulate the amount of stimuli coming through your processing system that you call a brain in the form of just like going for a walk outside. I mean, it just makes sense. It would,
and if you
cause some more sparks to fly,
you want to do, if you even want to get even better, you doing your own athletics training.
I'm with that. Is there anything else we should touch on before wrapping this piece up?
On absolutely everything. What I'm happy that we didn't touch on is nutrition. So that's good.
I don't talk about nutrition. I'm not into it. It's too dogmatic.
I've been talking about it quite often. And I don't know why. I've just gone into that field and been interviewing a lot of guests as it relates to brain health. And I'm telling you, Instagram ain't liking it. It's just too controversial. So I'm glad we didn't talk about it.
Controversy is good, but I just feel like I've done podcasts with the world leading experts in the vegan world and in the carnivore world and in the keto world and in like every nutritional ideology at this point. And they all have their data.
Yeah.
They all have their doctors.
Yeah.
They all have their empirically reviewed, you know, it's like they've all got it and they're all diametrically opposed to each other. You know, so for me, I've personally, now I guess we're talking about nutrition. I'm not going to, you know, go much beyond this. I'm telling you why I don't talk about nutrition too much. For me, I think it's just, it's so important for a person to like trust their own body and also seek out professionals that look like they're doing a good job. Like find a body that's like, cool, that's a good looking body.
Yeah.
What the heck are you eating?
Yeah.
Let's just talk. Can I get you coffee? Yeah. So we'll talk to you for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
What did you eat yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Jot that down. I'll try that. I feel like that's more where I trend compared to all of like the quote unquote experts that, you know, it's just tough. And food obviously moves in trends. It's like the Atkins trend and it's carnivore now. Yeah. You know, then it's like, you know,
I don't know what it is. It's definitely not carnivore. I don't know.
Who knows where
it's in everything. But where can everyone find you?
Well, this will also go out in the Align podcast. But people listening obviously listen to podcasts. So that's, I've been doing that for, we started it almost 8 years ago. I've done about 440 odd episodes. Wow. So people can check out the Gabor Mate episode. That'd be a good starting point. That was just a few weeks ago. I have a book called The Align Method.
Yes.
If people are interested in more utility around movement practices. So how do we start to make it so that your whole entire day becomes an opportunity to move better, which ultimately translates to thinking better as well. And that's it. Everything's at Align Podcast on social media.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And what about yourself?
The Neuro Experience Podcast, which this will go out on. You can find me on social media at Louisa Nicola.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you so much. This is fun.
Thank you.
I appreciate this. Yeah. That is it. That is all. Thank you for tuning in. Over and out.